Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, May 15th, 2007 Carrboro Board of Aldermen meeting.
There you go.
Thank you, sir. We'll begin our meeting with requests from visitors and speakers from the floor. Is there anyone who is here to speak on an item that is not on our regularly printed agenda? If not, then those of you who are here to speak on something, we'll call on you as we come to the item on our agenda. And also, please, if not think to call on you, then please just speak up or hold up your hand and let me know that you want to be called on. Before we continue, let me give you we have a proclamation this week for National Tourism Week. Whereas the travel and tourism industry in Carrboro and Orange County is vital to our economic stability and growth, and it contributes substantially to our cultural and social well-being. And whereas travel benefits every citizen by substantially enhancing our personal growth and education while promoting intercultural understanding and appreciation of Carrboro and Orange County's history, geography, and culture. And whereas tourism is a growth industry in Orange County, generating $127 million in expenditures in 2005, an increase of almost 7% over the previous year's figures, ranking the county 24th in travel impact among North Carolina's 100 counties, according to Travel Industry Association of America. And whereas state and local revenues from travel to Orange County amounted to $9.98 million in 2005, representing an $82 tax savings to each county resident. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, the mayor of the town of Carrboro, North Carolina, recognize the efforts of the Chapel Hill Orange County Visitors Bureau, and do hereby proclaim the week of May 12, 2007 as National Tourism Week in the town of Carrboro with the theme Travel and Tourism, America's Front Door, which illustrates the importance of tourism to Carrboro and suggests its impact as a leading industry for economic growth. This is the first day of May 2007. With that, I will turn to the consent agenda. Mr. Manager.
Okay. Item one is approval of the minutes of the previous meetings of May 1st and May 8th. Item two is a request to reset the public hearing on the land use ordinance text amendment to revise provisions related to daycare homes and facilities. Item three, we're requesting that be removed from the agenda and brought back at a later time. Item four is a request to set a public hearing to consider a land use ordinance text amendment related to affordable housing. And item five is a request to adopt a resolution awarding a weapon to a retiring police officer.
Move the consent agenda.
Second.
I've got a minutes correction. And should the motion be move minus item three?
Presumably. Let's hear your minutes correction real quick.
Okay. On the minutes of May 8th, on the last page where it says Alderman Coleman suggested the following, I think to better get the gist of what I was saying, I would like the last three items to be rephrased under a separate heading, which would say, investigate the possible savings in, and then 3 points, adjusting the sidewalk construction schedule, advisory board budgets, and the advisory board recognition dinner budget. If that makes sense. So I don't feel like I was suggesting, was not suggesting cuts, but I was suggesting that we look into possible savings.
All right. That's how I remember it. So is that the motion with those corrections and minus
sure is.
Item three?
Thank you.
And the seconder was who?
Me.
Is that good?
Harmony. Can somebody explain to me why we're removing item three?
We still have some details to work out with the City of Durham on the language of the agreement. And we had hoped to hear back from them today and didn't.
Okay.
Very good. So all those in favor of the consent agenda with corrections to minutes and minus item 3, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. Mr. Manager, we are on to item D1.
Okay. Item D1.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry, Mr. Manager. Before you go there, I apologize. We have a couple of things here real quick. We have a couple of charges for tonight. John Wilner, would you please come up to the... Yeah, come on up here, John. Come on up to the...
This isn't a charge. It's more like a discharge, actually. Correction. This is a certificate of appreciation for John Wilner from the mayor and the members of the Board of Aldermen who wish to express their appreciation for the contribution to the town of Carrboro by John serving on our arts committee. You are to be commended for the invaluable time and effort given toward the betterment of our community, not only through the arts committee of the town of Carrboro, but obviously through your professional work as director of the Arts Center. John,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, like I say, it's more of a discharge than a charge. That what translation of that is that John has cycled off of the Arts Committee. But we sincerely appreciate his participation on that committee, and John still represents us on the Orange County Visitors Bureau Board of Directors.
I was happy to hear that proclamation.
All right, excellent. Is Lauren Goers here? I didn't see her. Okay. We'll pass that along.
And then we have two charges.
Is Carly Apple here? No. Or Mary Rabinowitz? No, is not.
Yes,
here.
Oh,
there she is.
Maybe she is.
In the back row.
Yeah,
that's where those spitballs were coming from.
Okay, Mary. I'll read this to you and have you sign. As a member of the Environmental Advisory Board, you will advise the Board of Aldermen on policies, ordinances, and administrative procedures regarding environmental protection and the conservation of natural resources. The areas of review for the EAB include new development, solid waste, air quality, stormwater management, energy conservation, solar energy, groundwater, natural resources, and other areas. Two, suggest ways to utilize energy-efficient design techniques such as daylighting, siding, solar lighting, and other solar energy techniques as they become economically viable. Three, adopt a set of guiding principles or goals for the EAB and review these goals periodically to determine if they are being obtained. And four, take any other action authorized by the Board of Aldermen. Thank you. If you would like to meet this board.
Thank you again. Thank you very much.
Okay, do they want to speak on this one? Okay. All right, we are on to our main agenda at this point, item D1, receipt of the Tree City USA Award.
Town of Carrboro has been named a Tree City USA by the National Arbor Day Foundation to honor its commitment to its community forest. It's the 23rd year Carrboro has received this national recognition. Student winners of the poster contest are in attendance tonight and are to be recognized by the town, and posters will be on display. And George Size, our Public Works Director, has a brief presentation. George.
Thank you. This is not the wrong presentation. I just wanted to take this opportunity, since Earth Day was during the same week that we celebrated Arbor Day, and we had a group of volunteers that came out as organized by Dave Otto. And I'm not sure who all these people are, but they're good people because they picked up about 1,000 pounds of trash throughout the Adams Track, and also spent a good deal of time taking out invasive species. It was a cooperative effort between Dave's group and Public Works Department, and we provided some equipment and took away the materials. So I wanted to recognize Dave and his group and thank them for their efforts.
Can we put that on the website?
Yeah.
I'm sure we can.
I think that'd be nice.
And his group being Friends of Bowling Creek.
Not all of the. Some were, I think some of them were fellow workers. Okay. Again, I'm not sure
people
who all.
Together.
Yes, yes. Right. Dave did the organizing of the volunteers. Okay, on to Tree City USA. And congratulations are in order. and this is the 23rd consecutive year, as noted by all the leaves that we have behind here by the National Arbor Day Foundation. And this year we had another observance at Carborough Elementary School on Thursday, April 26th. Events included the planting of a tree, a crabapple tree. Mayor Chilton was presented the Tree City USA flag by the state forester, Jacob Presley. And students also competed in a poster contest. And as Mr. Stewart said, we have the three recognized winners here tonight. And just a couple of quick slides here. Mayor, the state forester, holding the Tree City USA flag, which we fly down at Public Works. Here are some students who read various aspects of Arbor Day history, J. Sterling Morton. And you might recognize these three folks. They're sitting out in the audience here tonight. Yeah, Gerardo, Elijah, and Shira. And here's the tree planting. After the indoor ceremony, we went outside, and Smokey the Bear showed up. And many of the students helped plant the tree, as well as Smokey. And here are some of the students digging in. And here is Smokey.
He's 12 feet tall.
Played by a very good-spirited Public Works employee.
Very sweaty.
And here's the final product after the tree was done. Just before I ask the students to come up, I wanted to thank our town staff, Paul Helwig, our landscape and ground supervisor, and Lakeisha White-Kelly, our administrative assistant, Public Works, who helped organize the event along with teacher Carol Gross at Carborough Elementary School. And Mr. Mayor, if you'd come up, and we have some gifts for the winners. And as they were ranked by the school, third place was Shira Chalani. Shira, you can come up, stand right here.
Oh,
they were beautiful.
That's pretty.
Then turn toward the Board of Aldermen.
Thank you. Oh, very nice.
Here's a little gift for you.
All right. And second place, Elijah Long. Elijah?
All right.
Nice.
Let's see, what does it say? It says, trees are terrific, forests are too. All right. Thank you, Elijah.
And first place was Gerardo Alvarez. Congratulations. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, George. And I know George mentioned his role, but I'll just reiterate that our town staff member who really, without whom this wouldn't happen, is Paul Helwig, who's been working on this for several years now. Anyway, thanks. Special thanks to Paul for all of his work and to the North Carolina Forestry Department as well. All right.
We have a motion, resolution, attachment A, which I'll move.
Okay. Second.
All right. Resolution A has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
You may want to.
All right. On a lighter note, a presentation on proposed Jordan Lake nutrient management rules.
Rules establishing a nutrient management strategy and total maximum daily load are being developed for the Everett Jordan Reservoir, better known as Jordan Lake, to satisfy state nutrient-sensitive water requirements and federally mandated pollutant limits. The Environmental Management Commission has approved the draft rules proceeding to public hearing. One public hearing has actually been scheduled here in Carborough for July 12th at the Century Center. And Sid Miller, who I know wants to make sure you understand, he is with Triangle J Council of Governments, and he's not from the state and here to help us.
That's great, because I've got a bucket of rocks down here.
Well, he was fearing worse, but Sid has graciously given of his time tonight to share some information with the board and to give you all an opportunity to ask questions. So, Sid, it's
Thanks.
Yours.
Yeah. No Kevlar. Let's see. All right. So, I don't know what the level of education is here as far as these issues and so forth. The way I structured the presentation was basically in three parts, to talk about how we got here, where we are, and what might be next. I'm not at all wedded to the presentation, and I'm certainly invite
different levels, actually.
Well, so I'm going to go through this thing. If any time you feel like you want me to move on, just, you know, tell me to move on, I'll move on. We can skip stuff. You can break in at any time and ask questions. You know, I think that time might be best spent in just responding to whatever you feel, you know, you is most interesting or you might need. So, so this is the basic structure of the presentation. There are people here who can testify that what I'm going to talk about as far as how we got here is very much skipping over lightly on the surface. The basic of it is there's sort of these two bodies of regulation that are underlying what's being proposed for managing water quality in Jordan Lake. And one is a state body of rules, and the other is of federal origin. So the nutrient-sensitive waters is a state water quality classification that under which Jordan Lake was designated back in, like, 1983. And the other is total maximum daily load, which is a function of the Clean Water Act. So this is kind of the general timeline and some of the highlights of these regulations. The 1983 designation of Jordan Lake under the nutrient-sensitive waters. There were some limits that were imposed, mostly centered around phosphorus. Notwithstanding the permits that were given to wastewater treatment plants, somewhat independent of this, started looking at nitrogen. 1997, we had this Clean Water Responsibility Act, which was going to impose limits on nitrogen, again, on wastewater treatment plants. But there was a provision that was added in which local governments or wastewater treatment plant systems could develop a calibrated nutrient response model, which might, under some kind of scientific basis, offer different limits on either nitrogen or phosphorus or both that would have more of a scientific basis than the somewhat arbitrary designation of the 5.5 milligrams per liter of total nitrogen. And if you're glazing over on any of this, you know, let me know.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not glazing over, but I'm probably towards the low end of understanding with
okay.
this. Most of the nutrients and phosphorus come from lawns, from gardens, from...
Well, in a sense, you're sort of jumping ahead, but yes, according to the data and the modeling, the indication is that more than half of the loading of nutrients coming into the lake is coming from what are called non-point sources, which is anything but the wastewater treatment plants.
So
essentially,
that would be like
it's lawns, it's roads, it's development, it's atmospheric deposition. It's everything else. It's everything that's not coming out of the discharge pipe of a wastewater treatment plant.
And there's only one discharge wastewater. There's an intake. There's not an outtake there.
There are three major wastewater treatment discharges going into the upper part of the lake.
Okay. Cary?
No.
No.
Cary has no discharge in
entire
basin at this point.
Right. Okay.
It's the Orange Water and Sewer Authority. It's the City of Durham, and it's Durham County.
Okay.
Right.
That's for the upper New Hope Arm.
That's
right.
Correct.
Not for the entire lake.
No, for the entire lake, there's more stuff.
Okay.
The TMDL, this is something that's triggered by something called the 303D list, which is this sort of official list of waters that have been impaired or essentially broken from the sense of what are established water quality standards. There are waters that we have evidence that we've pushed beyond whatever standards we have set as far as those surface waters. So initially, Jordan Lake, while the lake as a whole and its entire watershed, which is close to 1,700 square miles, was designated nutrient sensitive, that was a state thing. The upper New Hope arm of the lake was declared impaired in the 2002 list, which triggered this federal process of total maximum daily load, which is where you figure out how far past did you go, what the lake could handle.
Right.
In other words, there are these pollutants being loaded. The lake can handle so much. How far did you break it, and what is it going to take to fix it? Mm-hmm. And so that was the upper New Hope arm.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently in 2006, yeah.
So when it's called maximum daily load, mm-hmm. does that imply a figure that to fix it is the maximum discharge you can have?
Basically,
that?
Yes, that's okay. Correct. How much can the lake handle and meet its designated water quality standard? So it was then in 2006, the entire lake was listed as impaired on the 303D list.
Okay.
Now, all of this is, I guess, somewhat academic because it has actually no implication for the management strategies that have been developed. Because the management, so this was added in 2006. The management strategies haven't changed. All that's changed is some of the regulatory bases for these regulations. So where are we now? This is one definition of where we are now, which are sort of the various documents that satisfy these bodies of regulation. So there's this total maximum daily load document, which goes back to this federal process, comments on which were due today. This sets sort of the targets that everyone in the watershed must meet in order to repair the problem, in order to bring the lake back to meeting that standard. The next two documents relate to the state's body of rules, which are designed, basically those define the strategy by which the state intends for us all to meet that standard. So they're related, but there are some different bases for them. And it's complicated. What it comes down to is the top document is something that the state doesn't approve, doesn't go through the Environmental Management Commission. It's something on which you all get to comment, but it just makes its way up to the federal government. It goes up to EPA and gets approved or disapproved at EPA, and you deal with it. However, the way this total maximum daily load has been written, it very much relies on this body of state rules. The state rules are basically what's expected to deal with this vast non-point source loading. So that they all rely on each other. Now, the state rules go through a different process on which the state very much gets to decide. What I was going to talk a little bit about now is sort of how the strategy is set up. So there are different kind of, there's a lot of moving parts, there are some big parts. So we've been talking about these Upper New Hope arm, there's a Haw River arm, there's a Lower New Hope arm. So what you see outlined in red towards the right, that's the Upper New Hope arm. And that's the part that the town of Carrboro gets to deal with. Below that, outlined in the darker blue, is the Lower New Hope arm. And then the much larger area with the light blue is the Haw River arm. Those sub-watersheds are defined based on segments of the lake that are defined by the hydrology of the lake. The lake behaves in different ways in different places. So for the most part, what comes down that Haw River arm kind of shoots through the lake and over the dam. The stuff that comes down what used to be New Hope Creek spends a lot of time there before it finally makes it out.
And that's just because of the hydrology?
That's correct. It's just the way the lake works.
There's a bridge across the lake that is mostly filled in, so it's more like a causeway across the lake. Mm-hmm. So it constricts down to this very narrow neck. And that area above is the Upper New Hope arm, and it doesn't circulate well with respect to the rest mm-hmm. of that lake.
That's right. But even so, the Lower New Hope arm also doesn't circulate well with that Haw River arm. There's not a lot of movement there either. So that's how the segments were defined, and then you can zoom in on, and this is a close-up that pretty much just shows more of the triangle region that's of concern in this whole business. But you get a clearer picture of where Carrboro fits within that Upper New Hope arm. So one of the benefits of being in that Upper New Hope arm is that you have much more stringent limits that are being imposed than anywhere else as far as the watershed.
What do you mean by more stringent limits?
Lower targets.
Lower targets.
Yeah, you have to get to a much lower level in terms of the nutrients that you export to the lake than any place else. Any place else being the Lower New Hope Arm or the Haw River Arm.
And how is that a benefit?
I'm being facetious.
Okay.
You get to reach higher.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Understood that. That's
be an even more outstanding model. Yes.
So these are the targets that are being talked about as far as the nutrient reductions that are part of that total maximum daily load, that TMDL. And one of the complications of all this, you know, you'll hear this discussed in terms of reductions required. You also hear it talked about in terms of mass loading. Mass loading being the total amount of tons of nitrogen or tons of phosphorus per year that any given part of the lake can assimilate without degradation, without going past that water quality standard. So here I'm showing it in terms of percentage of reduction, which is how you see it most often expressed. That is percentage reduction from what is called the baseline period, which ends at 2001. So in other words, however the world was in 2001, you start from there and you say you have to reduce it by 35% as far as nitrogen export and 5% as far as phosphorus. So my guess is that now it's 2007, the situation hasn't gotten better. So what does that mean functionally? That means you're actually looking at higher percentage reduction now, right? Considering the world as it is now, it's more developed, there's more non-point source pollution, you still have to get to 35% reduction from what it was in 2001. Does that make sense? And you can see the lower New Hope arm, it says zero, right? No reduction from what it was in 2001. What's that saying? It's saying hold the line to what it was in 2001. Well, my guess is they've blown that already, and you're actually talking functionally about some kind of reduction from where it is now to get it to where it was in 2001. And the Hot River arm, not quite as bad as the Upper New Hope arm. Point sources, non-point sources. They're dealt with differently. Theoretically, they're being held to the same amount of reduction as categories, right? So point sources, well, let me back up a little bit. Okay, so they figured out the lake's getting too much in respect to nitrogen and phosphorus. You have to reduce that. It's coming from point sources. It's coming from non-point sources. They figured out how much the lake can take and meet its water quality standard. Then what they do is they allocate that to the different sources. They say, okay, you can load this much. You can load that much. If everybody meets their limits, the lake's going to be okay. It's going to get better. It's going to meet its water quality standard. Now, the points, but, okay, so you say that for non-point sources, you say that for point sources. Now, with respect to the point sources, you know, you have these wastewater treatment plants, they have pipes, they discharge. It doesn't go right into the lake. It travels a certain distance. Stuff happens in the stream. There's a certain amount of processing that occurs. There's a certain amount of assimilation that occurs, such that what is discharged from the pipe is not exactly what is received at the lake. The closer that you are to the lake, the more direct that relationship is, the more, you know, the closer to one. The farther you are from the lake, the more stuff that happens to those chemicals before it gets to the lake. So, in short, the further from the lake you are, the better off you are. You can load more, you know, you can export more, less of it's going to get to the lake. You guys are closer to the lake. So what they did is they took those major sources for the Upper New Hope arm, for all the different point sources. They figured out how far you are from the lake. There's something called a transport factor that's applied to what you discharge to calculate what gets to the lake. They took those allocations into consideration. They took that division into point and non-point into consideration. They came up with what's called an equivalent concentration. What this means is that when all of the point source discharges are discharging their wastewater at the limit of flow specified in their permit, then considering those allocations, This is the equivalent concentration to which you'll be held. So, in other words, when Owassa reaches its permit limit, which is 14.5 million gallons a day, whenever that time is, the amount of loading that they're permitted, that what they can export at that flow is 3.04 milligrams per liter of total nitrogen and the 0.23 milligrams per liter of total phosphorus. And that is important because it suggests a level of technology for treatment. All right. So what does that mean? It means that, well, in the case of Owassa, they probably have the capital improvements, sort of the physical wastewater treatment structure that they need to meet this. It's not going to require, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars improvement in order to meet this when they get to the 14.5 million gallons a day. However, there will certainly be operational costs. There will be chemical costs in order to do that. Now, contrast that with the Hall River arm, in which they don't deal with nitrogen treatment. They sort of deal with phosphorus treatment, and they're looking at larger improvements in order to meet even the limits that have been imposed for them. So that's that about that. With respect to the non-point sources, again, it falls back on those body of rules, which we'll talk a little bit more. It gets fuzzier when you deal with the non-point sources. This is the body of rules. I think there's 12 of them, 12 or 13, I don't know. There's a lot of rules. I provided a summary, which I think is in your handout, which just sort of gives a brief about each rule. There is the rule document itself, which is, I think, is over 100 pages.
Which you can get from the Office of Administrative Hearings website.
Can you? Mm-hmm. You can also get it. We have a project website you can get it from as well. And I'd be happy to send you the PDF and what have you. Yeah. Yeah. It's
thank
good
you
reading.
Thank you,
reading.
No.
The link will be fine.
In general, the rules are largely modeled on what was done in the Neuse River Basin and Tarpanlico River Basins. There are some very notable exceptions. It certainly goes beyond. This represents a whole new level for the state as far as managing nutrients and managing water quality and managing non-point sources. It goes beyond anything that's been done, especially with respect to existing development. Especially with respect to existing development. They're also doing something a little different with riparian buffers. I think the major difference with riparian buffers is that rather than it being a sort of a state rule and the state administers it, it gets delegated to you. You get to administer it.
An unfunded mandate.
Yeah, they're all, well, I have something to say about that. But
which we'll have to fund.
I went through the rule, and I went through the fiscal analysis. Fiscal analysis is even longer than the rule.
I'm sure.
And I just sort of jotted down some general comments. They're certainly not exhaustive, and there's certainly more that I'm sure could be unearthed. Durham County is submitting comments, should have submitted comments today on the TMDL. There's some more stuff in there.
Do you think, I don't know if this you're going to get to this, or at some point, could you sort of, in layman's language, outline some of the things municipalities might in the future be doing to meet these, like what some of the mitigation
I may be able to talk generally about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I can talk generally about it. There's not a lot, that's a whole other issue. What I can do, so I have some general strategy concerns, which you see here. The strategy as a whole, it's designed to achieve these limits at the lake, these different segments of the lake. Point sources are part of it, but there's no way all of the reduction necessary to meet the water quality standard can be achieved by point sources.
Right.
According to the modeling. And, so you either believe the modeling or you don't. But if you believe the modeling at all, point sources can't do it all, which means non-point sources are very important, which means that the rules are very important. And it means all of the sources, all of the non-point sources of nutrients are important and need to be addressed.
But they don't apply to homeowners. They only apply to people that work on landscapers.
Thank you.
But there's no regulatory framework for anyone to say, if I decide to put Scott fertilizer on my lawn, which I do not, and you can tell that I don't, also tell that I don't irrigate my lawn either. I guess what you might call a lawn. There's dirt in front of it. But, I guess the bottom line is, what are we going to be responsible for?
So you're talking about the individual existing homeowner who maybe fertilizes when he shouldn't.
You see the Scott fertilizer commercial all the time. Mm-hmm. It's summertime, and you see the young family running through the grass, and you have the guy that says, Put that Scott fertilizer on, and you will have a green lawn just like that.
And then use half of the Wassa's water after you put the fertilizer on.
So,
yeah. Rinse it into the creek.
Yeah, rinse it into the creek.
So under the proposed rules, you as local governments are not at least immediately directly responsible for that. However, you are responsible in general for trying to get reductions from the development that you have. So, you know, theoretically, that's sort of one element.
Here's the problem with that, though. You got some places that have a 40% open space ordinances, like we do. You have some places that don't have any open space ordinances. So they're putting more impervious surface, creating more of the issues that lead to the loading of the lake pollutants. And yet we are required by law, as I understand it, and they are applying the same standard despite the fact that we do more. Mm-hmm. That seems to be unfair.
Well,
I'm just saying, from my point of view, it seems to be unfair.
You have an argument.
Well, that's kind of a question I think we have for you, if you have any perspective. How do we achieve fairness?
Well, so that goes back to the fundamental allocation of nutrients. And there are many ways to do it. Two major approaches, which are different, that I can think of easily off the top of my head are, one, which is a uniform reduction across the watershed, which is what the state is doing. They're saying 35% across the watershed. No matter what you did in the past, no matter whether you were good or bad, you get 35%. Another way of doing it is to say that this is the amount of load that can potentially come from the Upper New Hope Arm. Let's move that equally across the entire area and say that is the standard to which everyone must achieve. If you've been good in the past, you're going to be closer to there. You'll have less to do. If you've been really bad, then you're going to have more to do to try to get there. The state has gone with the uniform percentage of reduction. You can comment on that.
When can we comment?
You may comment on that soon. So if you want me, so jump ahead.
I think she's getting ready to real soon.
Jump ahead in the process.
That's where the deadline today of today
no,
was?
That is the TMDL.
Okay.
So I think that the TMDL is of less importance for local governments than the body of rules. The body of rules should be published in the North Carolina Register on June 15th. I'm not sure when the clock for public comment starts. It may be stated in the Register and
it'll
maybe
be stated
an
in the Register. It'll be stated in the Register and on the website.
So that'll be June 15th. And then, you know, there'll be a 60-day public comment period, and there will be public hearings. Now, the public hearings had not been officially announced by DWQ because they wanted to be sure about when they were going to publish and they wanted to confirm the location and so forth. You probably have advance notice over most about when the public hearing will be held in the Triangle region.
They're using our facility.
There you go.
There you go.
Okay, can you reiterate what those two methods are?
So the TMDL is that EPA document.
Okay, one is uniform percentage across.
Well, so you can comment on that. I mean, you could have commented that in the TMDL, but you can also comment that on that in the rules that are being proposed. Because everything,
but
so
what are the
rules
two, were,
subsumes.
You sort of outlined two alternative strategies earlier.
Right. That's what I'm trying to get.
So one is to, So one is to say that everybody, that you take whatever loading allocation that is to be allowed for non-point sources, and you apply that equally across the whole land area, right? So, for example, if you say 100,000 tons of nitrogen can come from the Upper New Hope Arm and the lake will be okay, you just divide that equally over the land surface. And so what it comes down to is you have an aerial loading limit, and whatever it might be. It might be four, who knows? It might be 4 pounds a year. It might be, I don't know what it is.
And so are we then able to figure out what's coming out just of Carborough?
Well, then your limit would be that aerial loading limit, right, mm-hmm. per acre, and you'd multiply it by whatever the jurisdictional area of Carrboro is, and you'd say, okay, that's my allocation. Mm-hmm. That's the limit I must achieve. And so wherever you are now compared to that is you know, tells you what you have to get to. And if you've been really good, then you're going to be close or you'll be under. If you've been really bad, you're going to be way over.
Okay, but that then gives us the benefit of the kind of things Joel is talking about.
It does. That advantages rural areas. It advantages non-developed counties. It disadvantages highly urbanized areas, downtowns, makes it very difficult. So you have to think about that.
But it also advantages urban areas that choose not to have sprawling mega malls as compared to those that do.
You would think. Oh, no. Looking across the jurisdiction as a whole, that may be so.
Just
so you have to think about that. So there are some gaps in the rules. Some of the things that concern me, you know, on-site wastewater is not addressed. It's under county health departments. The State Division of Water Quality doesn't feel they have any control over that. They said they're going to work with county health and that sort of thing.
I'm sorry. I need to back you up again.
Yeah.
Because we'd asked you what those two alternatives were, and you restated the first one, which is to apply it equally across the land area. And the second one
is what you're getting, which is the uniform percentage reduction. So wherever you are, reduce 35% from there.
And that's currently
what's proposal.
Okay.
I'm really sorry. I come at scientific information from a social work perspective, so I don't often get it. Okay. It seems to me that the last thing that the rules don't address, on-site wastewater, land application, forestry, that would be like saying, let's not have a speed limit as we work on reducing speed problems. You know, so the sources of the real problem are not being addressed in the rules?
Well, one can argue that forestry might be a relatively small part of the overall problem of pollution loading.
But land application and wastewater?
On-site.
On-site
wastewater?
That's the septic
system,
right.
Spray fields. Well, spray fields are covered.
And is there any movement at all on the part of the state to limit the use of lawn products, which end up in the water, or is there any movement? I think a really good idea would be to have a surcharge on every bag of fertilizer that's sold, so that then pays for all this mitigation. But that's like too sensible an idea to actually go anywhere. So I don't think anything would happen with that in the great state of North Carolina. But it just seems like you're getting pushed into a corner where we're going to have to really do a whole lot of stuff that isn't going to be effective anyway.
Well, the body of rules does to some extent address that sort of application of fertilizer. There is a nutrient management rule which says, you know, commercial applicators and people who apply over larger areas have to either get training on how they should be going about what they're doing, or they have to file some kind of plan which describes how they go about doing what they're doing. That doesn't address the individual.
But that's only for, like, people. Isn't some of it to 10 acres or more?
Isn't there that? I don't remember the acre limit. It may have been 10.
So if you have an acreage that's less than 10 acres, you don't have to get a permit.
If you're a commercial applicator,
right.
Like if you're like Chemlon.
Yeah.
If you're Chemlon, then presumably you would. But if you're you know, Joe Sixpack with your little fertilizer hopper, you can keep on doing what you've been doing.
But then you'd have to determine if Chemlon was actually fertilizing things or parts of the land in excess of 10 acres, because if Chemlon's target,
it's an either or in the rule. It's an either or in the rule. So if Chemlon is doing a 1-acre lawn, they still have to know
oh,
what
okay.
they're doing.
Okay.
Sid, I have a question. Would you go back to the map for a minute? Because
this?
No, the map of...
the map.
The, right. The,
I thought you said math.
No. On the two scenarios with the allocation, in terms of the allocation of nutrients, I'm thinking about, for example, let's say the Haw River watershed area. Chatham has just mushroomed mega golf courses, which I'm sure there's a lot of nutrients that are being used on those golf courses. That seems to me, percentage-wise, a much higher use of those products. How is something like that mitigated?
Well, so you're mixing a couple issues.
Because the two plays golf.
One is whether that stuff happened before 2001 or after.
Oh, definitely after.
So if it's after, then it's counted as existing development within the rules, and Chatham County is responsible for fixing it. So even if it occurred after 2001, but if it occurred before the rules are promulgated, which probably won't be until at least 2000 summer of 2008 is probably the earliest, then it's counted as existing development, and Chatham County has to figure out what to do. Now, aside from that, because it's golf courses and it's nutrient management in terms of fertilizer, it's also covered under that whole use of fertilizer business. So presumably, whoever is doing the work on that golf course has to learn how to do it properly and presumably does a better job.
Well, but when you look at the quantity that is used over the course of a year,
mm-hmm.
for example, the average homeowner would not be using that much fertilizer. There's just no way.
But the other critical problem is if they're going to fund enough people to check if those people are going to be trained. Because if you don't fund that, people enforce regulations. So what is the mechanism to ensuring that you, in fact, have to either register and then take the class? And, I mean, how is that going to be checked?
Same way as Progress Energy checked their security course.
The practical administrative issues, that if you're going to set up some regulatory structure or framework, there has to be people.
Well, so they've been doing this sort of nutrient management stuff in the Tarpanlico and Neuse River basins, and it's been managed through, I believe, the Ag Extension offices. They sort of organize these trainings, and they may do some paperwork. My guess is that with respect to monitoring enforcement, as most everything in environmental management, it's probably complaint-driven. Someone has to catch somebody doing something wrong and make a call, and somebody has to follow up.
But who would know? Who would know if you were just out there, and unless it was some sort of discharge?
The algae police.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, and who knows? Yep.
That's ridiculous.
Whistleblowers.
Yeah. They gotta know to whistle though.
Or care.
No whistle.
So.
Sorry.
I guess let me just skip to what I see. Let me just skip to some of the major concerns, and we talk a little bit about going forward and some of the things I think you should think about as this ball keeps rolling. I think the agriculture rule is weak. I think that's been true in general across the state. I think the only people who would argue with me would be Farm Bureau Federation people. With the ag rule as it's set right now, whatever's defined by it as agriculture, basically they just have to implement one of any of a list of sort of standard ag BMPs, and they're considered all set. And they could have done that at any time, regardless of that baseline period. So in other words, if a farmer had introduced some kind of field filter strip back in 1992, he's all set. He doesn't need to do anything further. So when you think about that sort of baseline period, reductions that need to be achieved and so forth, you'll see that there's no relationship. Now, that may be less important in the Upper New Hope arm because there's not a lot of farming going on anymore, and there's probably less and less every year. For the rest of the lake, it may be more of an issue. So 612 million so far was the result of the draft fiscal note, estimation of local government cost to do this stuff.
We'll surely pay out.
My look at the fiscal note suggests that that's probably low, and I'm sure there are people in the audience who would agree.
Sorry, that's 612 million or so over what area? Is it for all three arms?
It's for the whole watershed.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lump cost, and it's over a 20-year period. There's no net present value that's been done. There's been no inflation rate. There's been no discounting, nothing like that. Mm-hmm. It's just this sort of rough estimation. There's a lot of assumptions that go into that, of course, and one can question many of the assumptions and come up with, I'm sure, a radically different cost. I think the bottom line is, it's going to be expensive. One can argue in the same vein that there is no estimation of benefits. Now, ultimately, I don't know how much it matters because this is not the Corps of Engineers, and someone is not going to say, oh, you have to have a benefit-cost ratio of 3 in order for the project to fly.
That has to work.
But it's a point of information. One of the big things for local governments, and I think for the state as a whole, no one knows how much this is really going to cost, and you're not going to know until you go through basically a painstaking analysis of how you're going to meet it. You have to do a feasibility study and an implementation plan. It's required by the rule. You have 3 years to knock it out. And when you're done and all the other local governments are done doing this, then everyone will know how it might be done, if it can be done, and how much it's going to cost. And it's not until you and everyone else does that that we really know.
So when would that be due?
3 years, 36 months from when the rules are promulgated. So if that occurs in summer of 2008, which is probably the earliest it might,
2011,
then 3 years after that, you're supposed to be done figuring it out. Now, meanwhile...
Well, now, is everybody going to do it the same way? Are there going to be some standards so that...
No.
No. So that's something to think about. Hold that thought. Meanwhile, while you're all doing this, while you're all figuring this out, while the rules are trying to twist their way through the process, anything that's been built since 2001, you know, meanwhile you're approving stuff, stuff's in the pipeline, stuff's getting built in Chatham County, all of that's counted as existing development that has to be retrofitted at some point in time to meet these new standards. So what does that mean? That means that while you wait, while you figure it out, while you hope that something else might happen, the cost is being shifted from the developer to you. Now, what happens if, while you do these feasibility studies and implementation plans, you figure out, everybody figures out, we can't do it, can't get there? What does that mean? I don't know.
I guess
the strategy depends. The strategy depends on you all getting there. I don't know what happens if you don't. And the last thing I want to say is about money, which is, I think that there are some inherent inequities in the strategy, and I don't know that there's necessarily any way to address those inequities, really. And so, therefore, I think that this is a case in which the state really must commit to assisting with the funding of implementation, because there is an inherent disparity and who pays and who benefits from the lake. And it's those sorts of inequities that it's the role of the state to deal with.
All right. Well, you've obviously taken leave of your senses, Sid, so I'm going to
cut me off.
Cut you.
Let me just end by saying that it is important that you comment on the rules. The TMDL was not as important as your comments on the rules. The public hearing, it'll be fun, it'll be a circus, but your written comments will actually be more effective.
Well, I have a suggestion for the board. I think we should direct staff to provide written comments during the rulemaking process from the town of Carver and join with any other comments that they would agree with from Triangle J and any other municipality that's going to be commenting on them that shares our point of view.
I know that Environmental Advisory Board has been working hard on this.
Sid, is there any reason why the county shouldn't be concerned about these rules?
Yeah. I don't know.
Are they going to have to do the same kind of things municipalities are going to have to do?
To the extent that they, you know, to the extent that there's development, they're going to have to reduce loading from the development. They're going to have to look at their buffer rules and how they're being implemented. Orange County already, you know, they got delegation of the buffer implementation for the state. That's on the Noose side. It's not on the Cape Fear side. There's more they're going to have to do. And I think any local government should be paying attention and should care and should be plugged in.
John.
Question. And I'm proud to live in Carborough, and we're always ahead of the curve when it comes to environmental issues. And we don't need to wait for these rules to be developed and all that stuff. What are the cutting-edge municipalities in other parts of the country doing? Who are in the cutting edge, you know? Do you know, or outside in other countries, what do folks do? Should we start moving right now into rock gardens, you know,
best equipped to answer some of these questions would be Bill Hunt at NC State, who's sort of our regional stormwater BMP guru. You know, one of the things that people keep saying is LID, low impact development design, LID, LID, LID. Those are a series of practices that have been around for quite some time that have sort of been repackaged as this mm-hmm. new vehicle, which is the answer to... Right, right. You know, surface water quality problems. There's a lot in that, but they've been more effectively applied in less urbanized areas. It's very, very difficult and very expensive to treat runoff from highly urbanized, dense, paved areas. You know, your area around, you know, around Main Street and that sort of area, It's tough, and I'm not, you know, so the town of Cary did a study with Tetra Tech 2 years ago, I think it was, and looked at what it would take to retrofit a downtown area of Cary to try to address these sort of stormwater quality issues. It's just incredibly expensive. Doing stuff, you know, green roofs and sand filters and some of these things in urban areas just incredibly expensive. And yet, the standards that they want to apply to the Upper New Hope Arm make it very difficult for you to try to treat beyond that in the less urbanized areas to sort of offset the urbanized areas. You're going to have a very hard time not dealing with your downtown, and you're going to have a very hard time dealing with your downtown.
Okay. We already have, water shed all kinds of retention ponds, and we encourage, I mean, developers complain that, you know, it's too expensive, but we're still trying to push the envelope on this area. What are folks like in New York City doing that, you know, they're fully developed and...
Well, I don't think they are.
Everything goes into the water, right?
I heard a term at a conference a while ago called the sacrificial watershed, you know, and that's where you just sort of say, well, and that's this whole thing about use attainability analysis. So what I think is you have to go through this whole rulemaking process. You have to comment. You have to do your best to say, okay, this is what we can do, this is what we can't do. You have to go through those feasibility studies, those implementation plans. You have to go through that whole process. It's not till that's all said and done that you can collect all that information and say, yes, we can get there with the lake, or no, we cannot. And there's a whole process with the EPA to address that. It's called the use attainability analysis. So you take all that stuff from the local government studies and you say, yeah, we can meet the standard, or no, we can't. And if you can't, then you do something called a site-specific standard. You say that Jordan Lake can't meet the state standard. There's no way in nature it could be done. What is the standard that should apply to this lake?
We have quite a few people lined up here. Jackie, do you still have a question right now? And then Dan, and then Randy, and then me.
If we wanted to put forth ideas like the state putting a surcharge on pesticides and herbicides and nutrients, would that rule meeting that's going to be at our Century Center, would that be the place
you could
to put that up? When else could I, Joel?
You could, but the problem is that when they promulgate the rules, they're going to make a decision, the Rules Review Commission is going to make a decision whether, A, the agency has the authority to make that rule, and then people will go back and forth on that, and whether they're going to allow the rule.
Well, I just think the people who are causing the problem should be the ones to pay for fixing the problem.
But because they didn't propose the rule at the very beginning, they would have to start yet another rulemaking process to add that as part of the rule.
But I think it is worth going on record with.
Right.
Because your biggest chance of influencing the whole thing is going to be in the General Assembly, because it will go to the General Assembly.
Okay.
Because
so
it be
start now.
Dan and Randy.
So am I correct that the acreage assigned to Carrboro will be our municipal limits, not our planning jurisdiction?
Well,
is that correct? Or?
You're thinking of sort of those allocation approaches?
Mm-hmm.
That's up to you to advise, because at this point, that's not what's being proposed.
So what is being proposed?
What's being proposed is that uniform percentage reduction. So it doesn't matter how big you are. It doesn't matter where you are. You're going to achieve the same percentage reduction.
But reduction from what? The reduction
from
is still
what
from...
what you were at 2001. That's right.
But it's based on
the
land area.
Yeah, right? it'll be probably your jurisdictional boundary at 2001. Those calculations have not been made because the state does not feel that they have the adequate modeling tool in order to do that.
Okay.
So at this point, you don't have a pound allocation.
Okay, because one thing that occurred to me is you were talking about the developments in the interim before any new rules were in place, that but a lot of our development, or our more significant development, is going to add, we have a lot of voluntary annexations into Carrboro that wind up also increasing our acreage. And I assume the acreage would be at the point the rules adopted, like summer 2008, or is it, or
well,
do we not know that? Or?
Yeah, again, the way the rules are structured now, I don't know that any of that matters. If you've gotten development that's occurred, or you expanded in size since 2001, all of that new development that's occurred since 2001 is going to be held to this standard that's applied back, you know, that looks at 2001.
Okay.
So,
but my point is, and this is more a point to staff, not to you, is that if we were able to develop some interim standards for stormwater management and maybe perhaps some other factors, that we could make those conditions of voluntary annexations, that we would would annex developments that met certain standards in water quality runoff that would help us meet these goals rather than set us further behind. So that's a different issue than commenting on the rules themselves, but it's an interim strategy.
Right.
Does that make sense?
The uniformity of the study that the jurisdictions are doing, or the lack of, or the lack of a template that what is the potential to create a uniform way of studying it? Because it's going to cost. I mean, I'm just thinking of how much more it costs if everybody is reinventing the wheel. I mean, to me, that's square one on this deal. So, what has to happen to create uniformity on the feasibility?
I think the best thing to do would be for all the local governments within Upper New Hope Arm and perhaps the Lower New Hope Arm to get together when this rule, hits the pavement and figure out how collectively you want to go about developing an implementation plan that might be suitable for the entire watershed, because that way you can figure out where the best bang for the buck is going to be no matter where it is and sort of pool your resources that way. And when we get to there, we can talk with staff about how we might coordinate that sort of thing.
I was going to ask that if that's something Triangle J might be able to help facilitate.
Yeah, sure.
If you're...
Am I getting hooked off the stage?
No.
In about a minute or two.
Now you're going to get grilled by the mayor. Do these rules protect our drinking water supply in Carrboro? I mean, in other words...
It will benefit your water supply. It will. It's not intended. I mean, the target is clearly Jordan Lake, and these limits have been set for Jordan Lake. But the strategy is for the entire watershed, and the things that you have to do to meet these requirements will benefit surface water quality across the entire watershed.
One of the issues that I know we've looked at in the past, and I mean 10 or 20 years ago, to my recollection, is that parts of the watershed for University Lake and Cane Creek are in neighboring counties where maybe not quite the same level of emphasis on water quality, particularly our water quality, is placed by some of our neighboring county governments. So, I mean, part of what I'm trying to get at is, does, just to be clear, the area that's in, for example, Chatham County that drains toward University Lake is pretty clearly shown on your map as, I think, as part of the affected area. Mm-hmm. Right, the green.
Yep.
And same thing will be true for our Cane Creek watershed?
Yep.
So Alamance County will have to take some special steps.
That is correct.
With respect to the part of Alamance County that's in...
Alamance County will have to do things I think they've never done before or contemplated doing.
Like zoning. I own a piece of property in Alamance County and there is no zoning on it. Okay. No zoning. Well, that's fair enough then. Okay. And so that's one question. How is the 2001 year selected as a baseline? Let me put that a little differently. Not why did they pick that, but is it a point that could still be debated about whether 2001 is the correct baseline year to use?
No.
It can't be. It's not
because
really open.
Because all of this is based on a set of models. The data for the models come from the period of time 97 to 2001. And therefore, since the models are what determine the targets and so forth, and the strategy is based on those targets, that baseline period ends at 2001. And so you can call that into question, but in doing so, the whole house of cards falls.
Because, I mean, in a way, it might be, for example, it might be more fair to pick a date like 1991 or 1981 to compare because collectively our local governments in Orange County have been, have a well, I think it's debatable about when we began our strong environmental track record, but the point is that it has been strong for several decades now. And so to choose 2001 as a baseline seems like it has some significant implications from an equity point of view for our community, because many of the things that we've done to protect our streams and our water quality began long before 1981 long before 2001, actually in some cases before 1981 too. And yet we're not going to get credit for that.
And that goes back to the approach you take for allocation.
Okay, so that seems like that's an important point in arguing about which allocation strategy is really appropriate. You pointed out that downtown's become particularly problematic and difficult because there's so much impervious surface and so much of it built so long ago typically. So let me turn to the staff for just a second. My understanding is that, for example, the basic requirements of Carborough's stormwater runoff regulations amount to that the new development can be no worse than what was there previously. Is the sort of basic premise of the ordinance. The question I want to get at is, if you're building a subdivision in rural in what is presently rural areas in northern Carborough,
that ain't like rural. That's urban.
Well,
you give people a wrong expectation to call it rural, and they end the Chapel Hill Carborough.
Okay, but fair enough. But for example, you know, the Jones subdivision is on a piece of property that is currently a horse farm or some such thing. And there are other subdivisions that will be coming in that are basically mostly green, whether they be grass or trees. They're mostly green right now.
I'd agree with that.
Low impervious surface at present, but the development will come. They're held to a very high standard in terms of, because what they're going to do is come in and build all these driveways and rooftops and streets and such, and eliminate a whole bunch of permeable surfaces,
right,
replace it with impervious surfaces, and then they've got to put in a lot of special features to try and slow that water down and reduce their impact back to where they were before. And there's a lot to be said in favor of that type of policy. But here's my question is, so, for example, the guys who are proposing to redevelop the junkyard in downtown Carborough, or any number of places where different people are proposing to do redevelopment of what is currently mostly existing paved surfaces.
That's
with
right.
New buildings, if they've got an acre of pavement there now and they replace it with an acre of building in the future, that standard doesn't seem to be holding. It seems inequitable that they're not really being held to the same standard that the developer in the northern part of town is being held to.
I don't think that. I'm going to have to disagree with you, because it was already impervious surface. And I think if you want, there are other factors with regards to what you lose when you say it's forest and rural. Because you're not going to have somebody knock a building down in downtown Carborough and make it forest and rural, no matter how many deer you see in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Or even downtown, because they're always walking downtown. And I don't think that we should get in the position, because there's pressure from this, to say that we're not going to put development downtown where we have always said we wanted development. Because part of the problem with the entire area, because it's just not Carborough, but the entire area, is that we have contributed to amount of growth, not so much Orange County, but an amount of growth that has put pressure on schools, impervious surfaces, and I don't think we should penalize people in Carborough for things we have no control over.
And since we want to talk about counties, counties next door to us, counties down I-40, counties below us, and counties to the west of us.
Right. I think to Mark's point, you know, it's, I don't think it's a question between not having a new building or having a new building, but it might more be a question of whether we require green roofs on new buildings downtown, for example.
But so we don't require residential development, even with the stormwater treatment, to the level of low impact or even the level of green or plumbing or electricity or solar or any of that. We either got to apply it to everybody or nobody. Because I think it would be unfair to set a higher standard, in my opinion.
Well, it obviously all of it raises some interesting questions. I'm just trying to get to the to the basic point, though, that, you know, the stormwater management practices that developers in at the north end of town are going to have to implement are going to be costly and very significant. But there could conversely be situations where downtown developers don't necessarily have to do much of anything in order to meet what the present standards require. And I'll just point that out. If part of what and you know, we're here to discuss in part influencing what these rules really should require. But if part of what these rules do require is that we do something about the amount of pollution, I mean, at some level it will, no matter what. It's just a question of how much. If the rules require that we do something about the amount of pollution washing off of basically the streets and parking lots of Carrboro, it seems to me that, you know, our downtown, the downtown redevelopment process, which is clearly underway, ought to play a role in helping to meet those requirements.
It should help to play a role, but let's be clear. If we don't apply the same standards, and this is probably a discussion we're going to have for a couple of years.
Absolutely.
You know, I just caution you, given a lot of pressures that we are under, that we need to think clearly about that and see what is the technology for doing so. Because I can assure you, we would prefer, in some respects, a more dense downtown than development outside of the town or to the northern area. That's why we have a rural buffer.
Right. Okay. So moving slightly over from that topic for just a second, as I said, it's fraught with interesting issues. You mentioned earlier a kind of transfer of responsibility from the developer, as it turns out, not necessarily intended, but an unintended consequence perhaps, but a sort of transfer of responsibility from the developer to the town governments that happens under certain circumstances because we're held to a certain higher level of responsibility for all the development that's happening after 2001.
And well, actually, the distinction is what's counted as existing development versus what's counted as new development, right? So new development is anything that occurs after the rules become effective. That's new development. And presumably that's stuff over which you can enact ordinances such that developers are going to have to meet a new standard of development. So
just for this purpose of this discussion, let's just pretend that the rule is going to become effective January 1st of 2009, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Just so we can have a nice convenient date to peg it on. So then tell me that again in that context. So basically the development that happens in 2009 and later, for example, if that were the actual date.
Right. So if the rules hit in 2009, then you have what? So what happens after that is the Vision of Water Quality – comes up with a model stormwater program for new development. They have 12 months to do that. It gets, you know, goes through some kind of approval process with the Environmental Management Commission. You then use that model to come up with what you're going to do for new development in the town of Carrboro. It goes to the state, gets approved, and within 18 months of the enactment of 18 months after 2009, so 2010.5, then you are controlling new development by through this ordinance requiring developers to jump through these higher hoops. So presumably they or their clients are paying for that cost of stormwater management, not so much the town of Carrboro.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, any development that has occurred up to 2009 is counted as existing development for which the town of Carrboro is responsible of implementing retrofits and bringing the loading coming from that existing development down.
You're saying up through January, well, again, whenever the rule hits, but in my hypothetical scenario, through the end of 2008. So here's the question that I'm really trying to, and starting when? Starting in 2001 or starting now?
Well, existing development is... is from the dawn of time.
Yeah, okay.
Is from the dawn of time. Uh-huh. Anything that was built, anything that exists as of the rules enactment counts as existing development.
So just hypothetically, one of the conclusions I draw from that is that if we anticipated that we were going to have a significant amount of growth, let's say again hypothetically that the rule was going to hit January 1st of 2009. If we knew that a significant amount of development was going to be built in 2008, it would almost be to our benefit to try and implement those rules a year earlier to reduce down by 1 year's worth of development the amount of sort of liability for this that the you know for existing development that the town of Carrboro.
So that is correct. Now let me just throw, of course, one further moving part or complication into this, which is that what the existing development rule really requires is for local governments to come up with a plan for dealing with it, a plan for retrofitting that existing development over some undefined period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so then presumably that plan has to be approved by the state. Theoretically, that could be an infinite period of time. You could say, yeah, we're going to fix our existing development. It's going to take us 1 million years to do it. Here's our plan. Now, my guess is the state's not going to go for that. But, you know, by the same token, it's not that you've got 5 years, you know, go fix it.
Right.
You get to define...
We have
period
some input
of time.
On the timeline, yeah.
But you are absolutely correct that if you think the rules are going to get passed looking much as they do now, it's to your benefit to try to deal with it as quickly as possible so that the town is less burdened by that existing development.
Okay. All right. Well, I know all of you came to hear just about this topic. Thank you very much, Sid. We really appreciate this. I know it's a long discussion for many of you in the audience to sit through, but as you can see, this is going to have some really significant implications for the town of Carrboro. I think our next step is that we're asking the staff to draft some comments and reactions for this next comment period with respect to especially the question of what would be the most equitable way to distribute the responsibility for compliance within the Upper New Hope arm.
And when can we get a reminder, when is the due date for those comments?
Has not been published yet.
It's okay. Triggered by when they publish the actual text of the rule, and then the time starts.
So theoretically, the clock starts June 15th. and you'll have 60 days. But as soon as I keep in close contact with the Division of Water Quality, and I will be one of the first they let know, and I will, of course, broadcast to all of you.
Yeah, because we have an issue in terms of we take a summer break in
Of August. Well, and that might be something you want to comment on immediately, but...
I wonder if, rules or no rules, we want to learn what the best practices are to start dealing with this proactively. And I know in Carrboro, we do a lot of good stormwater management and integrated pest management and all that stuff, that it would be good to put together, maybe consolidate those practices just for to refresh our memories and also to share them with other municipalities. Stuff that we're already doing that we might even get credited in the future when we have to pay those bills. We have been doing this for many, many years. Hopefully that will reduce our expenses when it comes to paying those environmental engineers. Okay. But is somebody consolidating these best practices, as would they just think?
Well, the state has a best practices manual. I mean, there's also a group at the North Carolina State University Water Quality Group that's working on a low impact development design manual specifically for the state of North Carolina, and we're assisting with that. Sure. So there's resources.
I just want to add again that the Environmental Advisory Board has worked very hard on this, and they'll be sharing their comments so that they've taken a good, thorough look at it.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
So feel free to call me.
All right. We probably will. Somebody will. Okay. Let's take a 5-minute break, and then we'll resume with a discussion of proposed OWASA rate increases. We are back in session. I'll turn to Alderman Brown for a motion.
I move to accept the report from Triangle J.
Second that.
It's been moved and seconded that we accept the report. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. We're on item D3, a presentation from the OWASA Board of Directors.
The purpose of this item is for OWASA officials to give a more detailed explanation of the proposed water and sewer rate increases as well as changes in the rate structure which are being considered by the OWASA Board. And Matt Clark, esteemed chair of the OWASA Board, is at the podium.
Thank you, sir. Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the board. I have just been requested by the mayor to be extremely brief. So while I have a nice little presentation here, I'm not going to make it unless the board really would like me to do that. You have in your package a letter which was sent to the mayor, dated May 8th. I think this covers the proposed changes in some detail, and maybe to expedite business, you would like me to go straight to questions from you.
That'll work.
Okay.
Alderman Brown.
What percentage of residential, what group, and I wrote it down, this is a multi-part question. What percentage group, when I look at these increases, the examples that you have on what we call attachment B6, which is examples of residential water and sewer bills, which is attachment 1, page 2, examples 1 through 5. Now, I was thinking about this. What percentage of the 6,000, the average 6,000 gallons per month, what's that percentage among the total residential users? That is, if there was a pie, where would they fit in that pie?
Those who use 6,000 gallons a month and under, I think, is really the question that you're asking, is it not?
Nope. No. I'm asking what the percentage is.
Of the 6,000 gallon segment?
Mm-hmm. That's the question I'm asking.
Pat, I don't know whether you have that number available. It is. I can tell you that up to 6,000 gallons is a substantial majority of our customers.
Okay. I'm sort of curious because there's a part of me that says if I'm in the average and I'm experiencing this increase, why shouldn't the people who use much more than I do bear the burden of the extra cost?
Does this perhaps help you to see the effect of the proposed changes?
Okay. But, see, that's kind of confusing given, you know, if I only use 3,000 gallons per month, I'm still having an increase.
Well, I would say with respect, no.
Well, it says, though, in example 4, a household using 2,000 gallons of water per month throughout the year, the current rate, well, yeah, that is a decrease. Sorry about that. You're right.
If you had 7 or
right.
8 or something.
Yeah, if it's 7 or 8.
They are not.
It's not really, I mean, if you use 10,000 gallons, which is almost twice the amount I use, give or take, you're only paying $2.41 more.
That is correct, but our problem, if I can call it that, from the conservation point of view, is with a relatively small number of users who use extraordinarily large quantities of water on a seasonal basis. And you can see for them, the 20,000 gallon level, then the increase there is a substantial one.
Not enough. I don't think it's enough. I'm just going to have to be very honest with you. That's not enough. If somebody's using 20,000 gallons of water, $62 is just like me buying my kids a bag of $2.99 M&Ms.
Exactly so.
I can bear that cost better than somebody that is poor who has to bear an increased amount of for water and sewer.
You're not thinking about the cavities, but...
Well, I'm not, but I made them brush their teeth because they didn't have any cavities last time they went a month ago. You can ask their dinners.
It's disproportionate.
It seems to me it's disproportionate. I mean, if you're really trying to get those large residential users, I mean, to not use that kind of water, it should be double that. It should be double that. And if there's such a small amount, then double it and see what happens.
What's the incentive to conserve?
Yeah. If I've got 62, I mean, if I had to use 20,000 gallons and all you tell me I have to use $62, I'll pay that in a minute. What? I pay it in a minute.
Probably washing all kinds of nitrogen and phosphorus.
There
in.
You go.
I'm sure I am.
I'm sure. Scale.
You know, it, I mean, you're still not penalizing that with the 9.5 rate increase. You're still not penalizing them that much. Mm-mm. That's a little bit of money. If you can pay that amount for water, that's a little bit amount of money.
Well, we have to bear in mind that the objective of the rates is not just to penalize customers at the higher level. There has to be some reasonable relationship to cost of service.
Mm. Well, if we talk about conserving water, because what happens is you're going to penalize me even if I conserve water, I'm still going to have to pay more. And there's really no disincentive for a person who's going to use excessive amounts of water. I mean, there's only a $5 difference between 6,000 and 10,000 gallons, give or take.
All right. Well, I think if your question is, were you going too far with this, you would have your answer, which is no.
Well, and my question would be, on whose backs is it being balanced? And clearly, you know, that's where I agree with Joel on the disproportionality. I mean, you know, on whose backs is the increases being balanced?
Because that's just water. Because your sewer rate, which is going up 13.75%, is calculated on a percentage of how much water you use. So it's not separate. Right? Is that the case, or is that changed?
No, this is the monthly bill.
Okay.
Pat?
Yeah, I'd just like to clarify that chart right there represents total monthly
just the water.
Okay.
And of course, it does, you must bear in mind that in a sense, the lowest rates, there is a negative impact in that there is a fixed monthly charge in front of the actual rate applied, which is the same, assuming the meter size is the same, for all customers in that particular group, regardless of what their consumption is. So that produces a negative impact. But even after allowing for that, we arrive at these numbers.
Is there...
Pat? I had some more questions.
Okay. Let me go to Pat, and I'll come back to you, Joel.
Let's work.
Can I make one clarification? Do you want me to come up there?
Yeah, why don't you come up, Pat? Would.
Thanks. I'm Pat Davis. I know most of you all. It's great to see you. I appreciate the opportunity. Just want to clarify, this column right here would be the monthly water and sewer charges that customers use in this many or billed for this many thousand gallons of water and sewer use would pay if we stay with the seasonal rate structure and increase that rate structure by the 9.5% combined water and sewer increase that we're talking about. So this column is if we increased the combined rates effectively 9.5% and also went to the proposed increase in block rate structure.
So the two columns amount to the same net revenue for OWASA. It's just a question of who you're correct. Putting the burden on.
Yeah. And also, if you were to look at what these users are paying under the current charges, just to give you an example, somebody billed for 6,000 gallons a month of water and sewer use, under the current seasonal rates, they're paying roughly $63, $65.
$63.56.
Okay, yes. Thanks, $63.56. And so with the 9.5% increase, they go to $69.74. Mm-hmm. But with the increase in block rate structure, their bill would not increase quite as much under the 2,000. You know, these folks actually at 2,000, they would see a decrease from their current charge with the increase in block rate structure. Part of the confusion in how these percentages work out, the seasonal rates cause some unusual things to happen because we have the high peak rate during the summer months. And so as we shift to increasing block rates during the first year, that pricing signal change gets a little confusing depending upon when that use occurs for certain customers.
We're still coming back to Joel in just a second, but this chart you're looking at would essentially be only for residential customers.
That's
Yes, we're only proposing to use this increasing block rate charge for single-family residential customers.
And just to help, so you're saying most folks are below the 6,000 figure, the majority of such customers.
Yes.
We've been making some assumptions up here about who it is that's using 20,000 gallons. I mean, why is it that some people use three times as much water?
Well, they have big lawns and big sprinkler systems, like to keep them green,
basically that simple.
Yeah. Okay.
There you go.
All right. Back to Joel. I apologize.
I'm sorry. And I'm going to take up quite a bit of time because I think this is really important.
Sure.
I'm really concerned because the added both sewer and water charges increase people's ability to live in the community. And I consider water one of those resources where I think people make a really concerted effort not to use a lot of water. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we don't penalize people that use a lot of water, it sends a bad message. And I just think it does. It sends a bad message. I was on the OWASA board for 6.5 years. I understand everything about what the capital improvements require, how the system is financed. But, you know, we talk about the cost of the system to the people. And for those of you who weren't on the OWASA board, who haven't lived here for 20 years, the system that we got from the university and that was combined is not the system that we have now. And, you know, for the citizens that live in this area, y'all gonna have to hear this again, we've paid for the system twice. We bought it when we were, you know, when UNC was running it. There are people who lived in Carver all their life that paid for it when they built the water plant. There are people in Chapel Hill who've paid for it again. And I think there needs to be a certain amount of thinking, and I'm not asking you to chance and not operate it the way you need to. But I think you need to always keep in mind of what place you are in when you're providing this service. And think about it. 9.5. What was the rate increase last year?
6.25%.
And what do you anticipate the rate increase to be next year?
You mean that the year after the 9.5 that is now proposed?
Mm-hmm.
8%.
And is that driven by the debt service?
That is a primary consideration. We have become concerned about our debt coverage ratio. During the 90s, our debt coverage ratio, and you may remember this, was generally in the order of a 2.0, around that number, very little year on year. Now, we then had in 2001, 2002, the drought followed by the deluge. And at that time, it seemed to us that it was a reasonable assumption, even today I would say it was still a reasonable assumption, that consumption would return to the historic long-term trend line. It has not done so. Now, that's good from the conservation point of view, but it's not good from the revenue point of view. The result has been that this year, the current year, our debt coverage ratio is budgeted at 1.4, which is uncomfortably close to the minimum debt coverage ratio that we need, which is 1.2, because if we were to fall below 1.2, the bond issuers are entitled to come in and basically take over the management of the utility. But apart from the effect on the debt coverage ratio itself and the effect that it may have on our bond rating, it's also a measure of fiscal prudence in how we run the operation. The time has now come where we need to restore that debt coverage ratio while at the same time we're making major, major capital investments. The investment in the wastewater treatment plant, for example, $50 million plus dollars, is the biggest single investment that OWASA has ever made.
Well, I would encourage the board and staff to look closely at how the revenues, because you're constantly going to encourage people to conserve, and that's going to remain an issue.
Surely. And if we do not achieve conservation, the financial penalties down the road could be even more severe, because if we do not achieve good conservation, then we are then faced with the problem in, let's say, 10 years or so, of the distinct need to seek an additional water source. because the stone quarry, which we acquired in 1991, will not be available to us as a water storage facility until 2030. So we have a critical area from 2015 or thereabouts until 2030, until that stone quarry becomes available to us and provides an additional 2.5 to 3 billion gallons of water storage.
And that's assuming the same level of growth, though. Are you assuming the same level of growth to the community or the same level of water use?
We are assuming now, well, that first overhead that I had up, and you may remember this.
Yeah, we've got that.
We have it out.
You've got that. The original growth line was that first section up to 2001, and now we're down to those five dots after the break in 2001-2, and now we are saying without reuse, which is the university's use of reuse water, our current projection is on that red line, but with the reuse and with conservation by citizens, we should be in that green zone, and it's a band rather than just a single line, because there is an element of uncertainty as to just how quickly and how much the university will be able to convert to reuse water.
Now, just so that I can understand this, is this band line assuming the development of Carolina North?
Yes, Carolina North is in there, and Carolina North has been in our projections for some time. Now, of course, it's fair to say that I think there is clearly an element of uncertainty in Carolina North, both the extent and the timing of the development, but we constantly use the best numbers we are able to get from the university for that, and we update regularly according to how the information becomes available, but it's in there.
I think I'm done.
Okay, Jackie and then Dan.
To pick up on a theme from our last item, the fact that not all of it, and I realize not all of it, but that a lot of this has to do with grass, with lawns, whether we're talking about the runoff into Lake Jordan or we're talking about the need for more and more and more water. And it has to do with grass. That is ridiculous. It's not something that as a society we would sit down and develop. No, and I know I've brought this up many times before, but I'm very serious about it. I would like Owassa and the town to finally get serious and start coming up with some ways, some very pragmatic ways of discouraging lawns and of encouraging alternatives. And it has to be real, and it can't just be models. And because it's ridiculous that we're spending all this money, that we're endangering our environmental health so that people can be surrounded by grass. I haven't had a grass yard in years and years. And I'm still okay. I would like to see the town. I'd like to see the town to, like, take the lead in that, you know, and look at expanses of grass that we have and what can we replace that with and how can we do a better job? Because look at this graph. And you look at the people who are using amazing amounts of water. I remember during the drought of 2002 being furious that I was doing all these things inside my house to save water. And then, you know, I mean, to the point of it was like a true sacrifice. And then 2:00 in the morning, the people next door had their sprinklers going full, you know. Anyway, I'm not going to let this go, and I hope that we can begin getting some serious support from Owassa in the town. I'd like to see it put on the town agenda after break.
I would say we are already active in this area. In fact, we have recently held 3 landscaping sessions to educate people in how to landscape the yard to minimize water use. And while you brought up the subject, I would mention that from the previous presentation, the economic impact of this is already significant for Owassa. Part of that $50 million-plus investment in the wastewater treatment plant is to upgrade facilities in anticipation of the likely limits which we foresee. Mm-hmm. And as a ballpark number, we think when these limits are brought in around 2016, which is the current estimate of when they may become effective, it's going to cost us in the order of $1 million a year extra for operating costs. to meet, in particular, the phosphorus limit.
Dan.
Yeah. I just want to point out that the lawn issue also has an impact on air pollution because of the way most people keep their lawns short. Mm-hmm. First, I want to come behind Joel, as Randy would say. I want to agree with Joel on the issue of the rate structure, and I think that both the 11 to 15,000 gallon range and the 16 or more could be significantly higher. It seems to me, without actually having data other than some informal conversations in my own experience, that most people ought to be able to operate in that under 10,000 range and not have the brunt of these increases. My next question has to do with education. You just mentioned having workshops about lawn changes. And I feel like I should know this since I open and pay my water bill every month, but I don't know to what extent OASA is able to assist customers in conservation efforts to provide education and perhaps materials on a household-by-household basis.
We do have materials available, of course, every month. We have our monthly publication, The Blue Thumb, which comes with your water bill. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, there are obviously a number of topics which are addressed according to what's topical at the moment. Mm-hmm. But we do address conservation issues and how to do it.
Okay.
Some frequency.
I guess what I would like to encourage is something, because I suspect that a lot of people don't read The Blue Thumb or perhaps don't read it carefully.
I suspect that, unfortunately, you may be right.
In this voracious reading community that we're in, that there might be some more prominent or attention-grabbing way, whether on the bill itself or with some other kind of insert, to inform customers of those opportunities, because I think there's got to be lots and lots of opportunities for conservation that people are not yet taking advantage of, and so I'd like to see that happen. My next point has to do with it's my assumption that under your charter, you're not allowed to provide direct assistance to agencies that might be building affordable housing, is that correct?
That is correct. On more than one occasion, we have been asked either to give some break on accessibility fees or alternatively some special rate for water and sewer to low-income housing of...
Well, I was thinking of
first of all, there is a difficulty in defining it, particularly when it comes to on the actual water and sewer rates which are charged.
Yeah, my question is whether you might actually be able to give a grant to an agency that is building affordable housing like Habitat or Empowerment or...
I suspect not. That would be my immediate answer. For example, we do have a program called Taste of Hope. I don't know whether you're familiar with that.
No, that was described in our packet.
Yes, and Taste of Hope is a program which we can operate because it's essentially at no cost. Mm-hmm. But the criterion that is fundamental all these is that in order to give a subsidy, however it's described, to some particular group of customers, we could not do that at the expense of other customers. In other words, mm-hmm. it's an intractable problem.
Okay.
I'll let you go and then I'll say something.
Okay. I think there's a widespread concern in terms of the connection rates. We're always looking for ways to try and keep the affordable housing we're building lower cost and to find ways to bring money into that pot. So when we look at this, what's approximately $1,000 per home increase, that's significant on homes that are already, I think the average subsidy currently is about $70,000 to make those homes affordable. And then we're adding per home to that. So if it is at all possible that it's within the jurisdiction authority of OASA to provide grants to help offset that cost that would come out of the rate base, I think that that's something that would build more economic equity into the community and meet goals that I believe all the local governments that are served by Iwasa and that are part of the Iwasa system share in that regard. So if you could look into that.
Certainly be happy to look at that. As I say, in all fairness, I'm not hopeful that
right,
we can
do
that, but certainly we're prepared to look at it.
And assuming that we probably will get a negative on that, that one thing I think we should look at in Carrboro is that we set a public hearing earlier this evening for the payment in lieu for affordable housing. And I think that's the public hearing we set anyway. That we have a document that defines how we can, under what conditions we can disperse from an affordable housing trust fund, and that offsetting water and sewer connectivity fees might be added as an explicit use of those funds once we have that set up. So if, Steve, if you could take a note of that, yes, since planning folks seem to have departed.
Randy, and then we're going to go back to Bill.
I want to go back to the question of conservation and education. Actually, I read the Blue Thumb, and I think it's great, actually. I really like
Thank
it.
Thank you.
I like some of the tips. I've used some of them. Back in 2000, I had to travel all the way to Greensboro to buy my rain barrels, and I used them, and they were great to have in the drought in 2002. And I'm interested in, beyond conservation, looking at catchment and looking at, implementation of cistern programs so that we capture and reuse. What can Iwasa be doing in those areas beyond, making a very nice list of ways folks can conserve in terms of programming and education? I understand that, if you're doing programming with landscaping, it makes sense to me to capture all that roof rainfall and teach people how to use that on lawns or use it to wash their car or use it to water their plants or there's hundreds of uses.
Well, certainly, again, we can look at possibilities here. For example, one that comes to my mind immediately is maybe we should run an annual rain barrel sale. There's some precedent there. Town of Chapel Hill runs an annual composting bin sale. So maybe there's something like that, and we'll certainly be happy to look at that.
I think more than just looking at it, think it's something.
Well, I don't know what the practicalities are. That's all I'm saying. I'm not saying that, that we'll look at it and forget it, but there are obviously practical considerations, and I'd like to get staff's input before I say more than that.
Wisely so. Okay, Joel, did you want to?
You studied mosquito pellets too.
Did you want to comment any further on that?
No, just to say though that when you talk about cost of service and people buying into service, there was a period of time where an institution didn't have to pay those same services, and then there was an agreement for them to do so. So when we look at, and I've made this argument before, when we look at the affordable housing situation, it is very critical in Orange County. And we have set up a system where we have a major partner in that system that can't play a part in that. And we have never had the political will as entities, both UNC, the town of Carrboro, the town of Chapel Hill, and Orange County, because we are Iwasa, to really discuss that critical issue. And it's going to become more critical when they start developing Carolina North. And so I would encourage the board, all of the boards, to think about that.
Well, I'm not entirely sure what you're asking me to do, but I would point out that UNC does now pay accessibility fees. They have completed the area that was exempt from accessibility fees. And so now they do pay accessibility fees just like any other customer.
But you have to understand, if you look at it on a capital basis, they weren't paying it before. And so they got a 15-year ride.
Well, for good or ill, that was what was agreed when OASA was established.
But if that's what was agreed, with all due respect, you don't have to maintain the same agreement if it isn't working for the community of which it is in. And all agreements, having graduated from law school and have held a law degree and a license for 20 years, can be modified if there's the political will to do so. And there just not has not been the political will to do so because we haven't reached that critical look and said, this isn't working for us.
So, Joel, are you suggesting that the local governments review the OASA charter with item modifications that would allow better sensitivity to housing affordability issues?
Yes. I've said that for the last, I've been an elected official for 9 years, and I was on the OASA board for 6.5 years, so I've been saying it now for 15 years.
So can we put that on an assembly of governments agenda when we have the opportunity to do that?
I think that's a good idea.
I believe I'm correct. This would be something that would have to be decided at state level. I think under the charter under which we operate, GS-162A, that would not be permitted.
Right.
Right. But if we could all agree.
Okay. Well, I can certainly raise that question with the chairman of the county commission and the other mayors in the county about looking at that issue. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So there's a motion to accept the report.
So moved. Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Thanks very much.
Quick question for the clerk, Sarah. This handout that was at our place, will this be included in the web packet so we can access it later? Thank you.
Mr. Manager, before we go to item D4, for D5, the Transportation Improvement Program, is that particularly time sensitive? I mean, are our comments on this needed this week?
No, what really needs to happen, Trish, correct me if I'm wrong, is the board ultimately just needs to refer this to the TAB for comments back.
I'm not talking about the Smith Level Road. I know the board's going to want to have a discussion, but for the TIP generally, we could potentially.
You could simply refer it to the TAB.
Is anybody?
Yeah, that's
good.
So
moved. All right. So moved that item D5 be referred to the Transportation Advisory Board.
D5.
And moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. So we're just going to have two remaining items on our agenda, Smith Level Road and the Rogers Road. The latest Rogers Road Task Force.
Another one.
Mr. Manager, item D4, Smith Level Road.
This is a review of the revised plan for Smith Level Road transportation improvements. And the transportation improvements to Smith Level Road have been included in the town's local TIP priority list and the state TIP for many years, as you all know. Mm-hmm. Meetings and correspondence with the North Carolina Department of Transportation regarding a cross-section and design elements that are to be included in the project have been ongoing. A revised plan has been provided for recent discussions, and a resolution specifying next steps is provided for the board's use. Before Trish starts, Adina Messinger, who is passing out items to you all, is our new transportation planner. I wanted to introduce Adina to you all and to the public. Adina started with us on May 3rd, so she's been with us about 2 weeks. She most recently worked for NC State in the area of transportation as a transportation planner. Working on campus and regional transportation, worked with the travel demand management and traffic calming programs, and also supervised the transit manager at NC State. Adina also has advanced degrees in environmental studies from Yale and a master's, I think, in city and regional planning from UNC. So lots of good educational background and good experience, and we are really glad to have Adina with us. So.
All right.
Welcome.
And Trish, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Good evening, everyone. This project has been going on for many years, and so I'm not going to say much about the past. In the recent past, though, the board's most recent action on this was to support a three-lane cross-section for Smith Level Road that the DOT presented back in 2005, and then to ask the town to advance the schedule for construction of the TIP project as it related to particularly the opening of the new Carborough High School later this year. At the end of last year, we received communication from DOT. There was attempts to communicate throughout 2006, at the end of the year, we did have some contact, and DOT began working on this project again. We met with them, that is to say, Mayor Chilton, several members of the staff, other members of the MPO, and staff of the MPO met with DOT in February and looked at what they had on the table for us, and we discussed it and made some requests for changes. And the design that you have in front of you is a combination of the DOT proposal from February and the response to the town's request. So the project scope is it's just about under a mile long. This project, just to recap, it goes from the Morgan Creek Bridge, the project actually begins at Rockhaven Road and ends at the Morgan Creek Bridge in the way it's described. There are three different components of it in terms of different cross sections, and my cross sections go from north to south rather than north. My descriptions go from north to south rather than south to north. But the C section up here is essentially a four-lane divided roadway with a median, a grassed median, from the bridge to BPW Club Road. There is a center lane section from BPW to Culbreth where there is no median, and there is essentially a three-lane road section at that point because of the turn lanes and so forth. From Culbreth Road to Rockhaven, the project is two lanes with a center turn lane. The center turn lane begins to become the tapering areas off the roundabout. The splitter islands, excuse me, is what they're typically, as they're described, with a roundabout at this intersection at Rockhaven Road.
Now, does the C-section, excuse me, have bike lanes?
The entirety of the project has curb and gutter and bike lanes. The project, of course, does taper a little bit beyond the end of Rockhaven with a roundabout right here. The road has to widen out and have that splitter island south of Rockhaven Road. So the taper takes the project down to about this location. It's 500 feet or so south of Rockhaven Road.
Okay.
There's not curb and gutter down there or bike lanes.
Okay.
So from Rockhaven to the bridge, there are bike lanes and sidewalks, curb and gutter.
You said you'd want a bike lane, so if you wanted to ride your bike.
Mm-hmm. We have at the table for you, and then also here, the very large PDF image of this design currently. So I can scan for you. The details that the DOT has included on here show 12-foot lanes. We've discussed narrower lanes with them, but this is a typical section that they've included on this preliminary design at the present time. For the four-lane piece, you can see the median section, the combination of the bike lane and the travel lane for vehicles, and then sidewalk area and curb and gutter and transition back to for drainage improvements, back to grade. Oops. Let's make this a little bit bigger. So here we are starting the project basically just over the bridge from Morgan Creek and then traveling south. This is a full median from this location where the cursor is down to, it begins to narrow right here for a turn lane into the University Commons development at BPW Club Road. And this is currently a signalized intersection and would continue to be so.
Is that what that represents, a signal light?
I'm not sure. You mean the icon in the middle?
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure if it is or not. I can zoom in and we can read the detail, but it is a signalized intersection.
It's not a roundabout. I mean,
it will continue to be a signalized intersection as it is now.
And does the right lane become the right turn lane there?
I think. Let's just zoom in on that.
Yeah.
Actually, because they narrow the median down, they actually do have a right turn lane that is. I mean, it's both. It's a right turn lane and a through lane there because they add this center turn lane.
That right turn lane gets just scraped off altogether as you head past that.
Yeah, it does. That's what happens at the intersection.
You lose
that's
that
how it's dropping
at the same
down.
Time you lose the median strip.
So that's how you're dropping down to a three lane at that point.
Okay, so to the south of that, then, there'll be four. It looks like four lanes, one lane going south and one turn lane and then one straight lane and one right turn lane. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
And this part of it is, you know, we had some discussion about this at the scoping meeting and details of it. I think there'll be comments from the TAB.
Scroll back in the other direction for just a second, if you would, so we can see the entrance to Berry Hill subdivision. So notably, One of the most notable implications of this would be that Willow Oak Lane would become right in, right out. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
So there's no
right here.
Right there. So there, where currently people can turn left in or out of Willow Oak, the proposal from DOT here is that there would be no median cut to accommodate that turn.
And we have had some discussion as staff about the possibility of, there are some examples of medians that are broken for bicycles to exit.
Yeah, but that's a tough hill there to see. What about at the other end of Berry Hill?
Berry Hill's on to BPW
that goes
Club
to
Road.
Club, okay.
So that would be the left turn entrance into... in the way you would get from sort of that direction into Berry Hill is you would need to turn on BPW Club and come around.
For the folks who live at the northwest end of Berry Hill, they're going to have to come all the way up and around, aren't they, to get out,
to go
15501.
Turning some of those interior streets into probably busier streets folks that live there would like.
Right.
And also, you're going to have people doing a U-turn.
Right.
At that entrance.
A bunch of high school kids going up and down there. Can you see that?
Well, yeah.
The particulars of that intersection have been discussed. I mean, that's one of the comments that have been ongoing. And certainly the benefits are that the site distance isn't very good right now. And there are some concerns about the left turn movements, and a lot of comments from folks in the community who were happy with the median, feeling that it wasn't a very safe turn to make anyway.
Oh, okay.
Median being
have folks from Berry Hill been?
It does. Others feel, you know, that they lose the option.
Have folks from Berry Hill
seen
this? You know, spoken about this or
no,
had a
no,
chance to comment?
This, you guys have
really
seen
this.
This
okay.
is a
yes.
prime time here, right tonight.
Yeah.
First time.
But the TAB will be able to comment, right?
We're going to send it to them.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I hope so.
Can we send a copy to the Neighborhood Association since it's already public knowledge?
Well, I think we might need to talk about doing something further than that. Can you finish showing us the... I mean, I think we need to have a broader community meeting about
no
this.
Question.
You can see this is a signal.
That one's,
right.
That's Culberth Road.
This is Culberth coming in from the west, from the east, intersecting with Smith Level. At this point, we're going back to, it's tapering down to two lanes, two travel lanes and a center lane, which would provide, there is a proposal for there to be a right turn lane into the village's entrance here and a left turn as well through that center lane into the villages. Otherwise, it would be a full three-lane, basically a three-lane section along three lanes of pavement along this part of the roadway. The splitter island begins right here for the roundabout at Rock Haven.
Right over that.
No, I'm just not. I'm still not feeling four lanes in a medium.
Well, it would be interesting. Can you take us back to that, northern section of the project for a minute, and where do you, right now there are places where there are right turn only lanes and so forth, so that the pavement. I can't remember how it all shakes out, but there are places where it is, although it is not two travel lanes in each direction at the present time, it is already essentially four lanes of pavement.
That's correct. Very much so in the proximity, right here at BPW.
Five.
Yeah.
So I'll just point that out, that part of that has already gotten really, really wide, but not necessarily as many travel lanes as DOT is talking about.
Right, and I've made my comments about if you make four lanes, people are going to use those four lanes. And
so it is five lanes here at the bridge.
And we've had this discussion about, if you're coming this way, you're not going to Chapel Hill. You're coming to Carrboro specifically. You're not going to make a, you could. But I guess my whole thing is, to be brief, and then I may not say anything else, was they spent all that money to widen 15501, and then they are creating this
parallel,
and I've always had the position of it should be in disincentive that they should actually use that four-lane highway that they spent so much time and money on. My money. And other people's money.
But we're keeping two lane for all the miles of Smith Level.
And I think more importantly than this, and I didn't quite say this in these terms when we were in Raleigh, but now that we're safely back here in Carrboro, I'll come right out and say, I think one of the significant aspects of the roundabout is that it is a physical barrier, not insurmountable physical barrier, but an important physical barrier to the possibility of a four-lane profile for Smith Level Road from there on.
Right.
And so this plan, it seems to me, does a lot to which doesn't mean we can't play around with it some, but it does a lot to physically ensure the rural character of most of Smith Level Road for a long time into the future.
Not opposed to the
No, I know. But I'm just pointing out that it's genuinely what's proposed here would genuinely be a compromise in that DOT is in fact getting some of what they have been seeking, specifically four lanes, basically a four lane profile from Culberth Road coming up to the bridge. So there's if this is what we decided to do, then there would be, that would involve some give and take on both sides.
Right. No, I understand. But I think I'd like to hear from TAB and the neighborhood and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to suggest, in addition to sending it to the TAB, that we, as I mentioned briefly earlier, that we have some kind of real specific community meeting. And I don't, I guess what I don't mean is a public hearing before this board, although we can do that too if that's needed at some point, but a little bit less formal setting to have a presentation to the public of what this plan would be, and invite property owners and other residents whose driveways lead directly or indirectly out onto Smith Level Road.
Right, exactly.
To come and comment on this proposed plan.
Just have a few comments about the schedule and what's coming up. And
sure.
Add those I can. The current project construction costs are about $4.3 million. That's in the TIP. At our meeting with the folks in Raleigh last week, they estimate that to be the actual cost to be about $500,000 higher, so at about $4.8 million for construction. With the total project cost coming to about 5.2 or 5.3 million. And they also have noted that per the town's request and DOT's understanding of the long time frame associated with this project, that they are they have committed to an accelerated schedule, which would move the which would advance the TIP schedule by construction, by all the aspects of it, but construction by 1 year, so that it would construction would begin to occur in fiscal year 2011 instead of 2012. That's if things move along and if there is some agreement on what happens.
If we accept this plan.
Well, I think if it's going to be, you know, as you said, a compromise. So we have scheduled for the TAB to look at this on June 7th, and then in the quarterly calendar for it to come back to you all on June 19th. DOT is planning a citizens informational workshop at the late in the summer to present the project essentially to the community again. And they have started the environmental assessment process again, an update of the one that was done in 2001. So other than that, happy to try and answer any questions.
If I might share a couple other thoughts or perspectives that came from this meeting with DOT, I think one of the things that became clear was that one of the difficulties for DOT is that you know this project has changed a number of times, and sometimes that's been because of actions that this board has taken, sometimes not, in my estimation. But in any case, as the project physically changes, they have to do or redo their environmental analyses of the project. And so they're, as Trish sort of alluded to, they are for a second time doing a whatever it's called, environmental assessment or whatever, of this project. And so I think the hope is that obviously DOT is hoping that that this project will meet with the community's approval as it's written here. I would also say, you know, I think you know, I guess my hope is that this project or something very, very, very similar to it can be approved, because the let me put it this way, otherwise the state winds up sort of having wasted money on an environmental assessment for a project that isn't going to be built. Now, that's not ultimately our responsibility to deal with that, but I think there's a certain level of one of the issues surrounding this entire project is just how important or what the opportunities are for maintaining a certain level of goodwill between the town of Carrboro and the State Department of Transportation. Let me just put it that way. Yes.
I just wanted to make two scheduling notes, which I meant to put on the slide. And the first was, we have informed the board of your set schedule for the summer regarding the scheduling of this citizens informational workshop, so that it hopefully will not occur during your break and during the break that many people take during the summer. And also, the Smith Level Road Task Force is holding a public input session this Sunday. So while they aren't going to be looking at the details of this plan per se, although perhaps you would want this sketch to be presented at that meeting or to be available for folks to comment on, it is another public input opportunity.
Yeah.
So, and they are, you know,
I think the
chair
earlier,
and the staff are working on the presentation. So
the earlier they have an opportunity to see it,
right,
the better. Because that gives people time to give some measured thought to their comments.
Trish, I just want to look at the Rockhaven Road for a moment. And I just want to be clear that Carrboro High School opens up in the fall. And so that area is essentially going to need to be redone. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
That's right. The improvements that will be made for right now will have to last until 2011. They'll be needed for the school to open, for the CUP right now.
What improvements will they be?
They're putting in a turn lane, left turn lane for the northbound traffic, right turn lane for the southbound traffic. I think they're putting in a turn lane coming out of Rockhaven, and this intersection will be signalized as a result of in conjunction with the school.
Because we will have a young driver driving there.
We'll have a lot of young drivers driving there. And that, by the way, that remind me, that is where the students are supposed to enter, is through that intersection at Rock Haven, is that right?
Yes.
Right. Sorry, yeah, the student drivers, I mean to say, are going to enter through Rock Haven. The buses are going to come through BPW Club.
And they're hoping that anybody who drops off folks will also come through BPW. They've got a queue set up.
Allegedly, okay.
That's the way the queue set up to get into the drop-off area. But
glad well, you certainly don't want to be seen dropping off over by the
driving
themselves. So right. Maybe that'll be an incentive.
I'm glad this plan, Trish, so, I'm glad this plan includes the roundabout.
John.
I just want to say that I agree with you, Mr. Mayor, that this project, to me, serves me as a lesson to see how painful it is to deal with DOT, how much power they really have. And I saw how Alderman Saffron struggled and went to all kinds of meetings for many years. And our former transportation director, Bill McKeel, also spent tons of time and going to meetings. And, I mean, we had wasted, actually, a lot of money. And hopefully didn't waste it. I think it's a compromise, that's what I see on this plan. And we got some, not everything we wanted, but we got the bike lanes, we got that bottleneck reduction there with the roundabout. And I want to recognize the leadership of the TAV mm-hmm. on suggesting it and pushing it and pushing the school board also. And just when everybody thought it couldn't be done, when there's a will, there's a way, and people figured it out. And the staff and this board who took the time to not to settle for the current proposed plan. So I think I'm glad to see it coming, and that's what I want to say.
Thanks, Sean. Okay, so... Yeah, I guess the one reservation I have is, so we're supposed to submit some comments, according to your draft schedule there, we're supposed to submit some comments to DOT on June 19th, you're saying?
No, I mean, I said you could formulate comments at that time. It's not required. We did tell the folks at DOT when the TAV was going to meet and when we were going to bring this back to you.
Okay.
We didn't say that you would absolutely have comments, but I put it in the agenda because we are planning to bring it back to you then rather than at the end of the summer. But it's really – they're hoping it can be as soon as possible.
Okay. And I mean, it certainly – it seems to me it would be easier to fully comment on the plan after DOT has had its session to make a presentation to the community.
Right.
Is that – are they
– Yeah.
I would say the only thing is that they're interested in the extent to which you support the elements in this design right now because of the time that they'll spend finalizing plans for. That's the only point I'd make.
We like the roundabout.
Yeah. <There you go.
laughs>
And the sidewalk and the bike lanes. Okay.
But
so,
really would have to hear from the citizens who are right there.
Well, let's Tom High is here and wanted to speak on this.
Having seen DOT's presentation on South Columbia Street and Phillips and all the money and effort that went into that, I would tend to think that they would prefer, if we can get citizen input and the board can have comments, that happened before they do that public presentation.
Okay.
If they see a couple of changes that they can say, well, we can live with this or we can't live with that, then they can incorporate that into that public presentation. It just, I think, helps the public be behind it.
Also, if this is not something, I mean, if this is clearly not something that the
right.
community is willing to do, then there's
no
point in spending
right.
anybody's time on it. But okay, well, let's do this for now. Let's refer this to the Transportation Advisory Board and also the Smith Level Road Task Force, and ask that the staff and the chair of the Smith Level Road Task Force try to work that in to the discussion on, when did you say it is, this Sunday?
The 20th, yes, this Sunday.
This Sunday. Where is that meeting going to be, by the way?
I believe it's going to be held at the Century Center. I think that's
the location. Century Center?
Yeah.
Do you know what time, Tom?
2 o'clock.
Is it 2 o'clock in the
afternoon? 2 o'clock on Sunday, the 20th of May at the Century Center. It'll be an opportunity to discuss Smith Level Road, both this project and a number of other issues on Smith Level Road.
Just wanted to note that this has not gone to the school board. There were discussions last summer about a roundabout, you know, in follow-up to the CUP and all. I guess it was last summer.
So there's been no endorsement
but
by them.
They have not seen.
They
this is the first vetting of this design.
Last year, so.
So if you wanted to find out what they thought.
Their main concern was about paying for it, as I recall. But let's do since.
When we met with them, they were concerned about the timing and the cost.
Their whole concern was the opening of the school.
That's right.
And staying in budget.
It's going to open.
Yeah, it's going to open.
So.
Right. They didn't care.
Yeah, I guess you could wonder how disruptive this might be to them. But, of course, roundabout or no roundabout, it's going to have some disruption
right,
with school traffic.
Right, it's going to have disruption
anyway. Anyway, so maybe we could also add the Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board to the list of parties to whom this is referred. And then I just have one other thing I wanted to put out there is so I wonder whether when is the Transportation Advisory Board meeting on this? On the 7th?
June 7th.
Of June. I wonder maybe for the 19th of June when it comes back to us. I don't know. Somehow we need to give certainly at an absolute minimum the people who live in Berry Hill
right.
some notice about this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We need to hear from them.
Yes.
So I don't know. Is there a way that we could send some notice out to affected to the stakeholders basically about the fact that we're going to discuss this plan on the 19th of June? I guess I was wondering about postcards or trying to take advantage of Homeowners Association email listservs or something.
I'd like to do as much of
that
as we can because this is their number one concern
right.
and has been for many, many years.
Well, and it's seriously going to impact, you know, a significant portion of the folks trying to get to 15501. Let's face it.
And it is going to go to the Smith Level Road Task Force, right, on Sunday?
Yes.
Mark, are you planning to go to that? Maybe. Tom, you're on the task force, right? You're on the Smith Level Road Task Force. And who's the staff person?
Kendall.
Okay, and she's not here. I just wanted to, my concern is that a sense of this discussion carry over into that meeting. And
is there a listserv that you all use?
Terry sent out emails to the residents, and she mentioned that there was a very ill listserv.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that the staff and perhaps also the folks who are on the Smith Level Road Task Force, if we could ask them to try and think of some strategies for publicizing the discussion that's going to happen on June 19th about this possible plan, that would be very helpful.
Let's make sure we notify the president or the secretary of the Avery Hill.
Right.
Neighborhood Association.
Right.
I know we've just been updating our Homeowner Association information.
Right. So. And I think particularly for Berry Hill, the sooner that we can let them know about this, the better.
Right.
All right. So is there a motion along the broad outlines of what I was just saying?
So moved.
So that's a motion to refer to Smith Level Road Task Force, Transportation Advisory Board, and Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board, and request the staff and the Smith Level Road Task Force to collaborate to inform people about the discussion that will happen on June 19th about this topic.
And May 9th if they want to come.
Right.
Well, for that matter, yeah.
Well, not May 9th.
May
20th. I'm sorry.
May 20th. Although I think they've already worked hard on doing some publicity, I think, for May 20th. But certainly the
I mean, if they can do a listserv, not mail or anything, but just if you can get
send
somebody's email.
Right. Okay. So is there a second for that motion?
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passes unanimously for now. That we are on to a discussion of making an appointment to the Rogers Road Community Enhancement and Monitoring Task Force.
Can I make a suggestion?
I'm sorry, Dan was...
Oh. Yeah, I was going to make a suggestion, but maybe it'll be the same. Well, I think we have three excellent citizen applicants for this, each of whom would bring different strengths, but we heard today from Jackie and Randy who want to be on that committee, and I think the knowledge and advocacy that they would bring and the history that Jackie brings would be very, very important. So my suggestion would be that we appoint both. I know we've been asked to appoint only one, but I think we could go ahead and appoint both Jackie and Randy and let Moses flip a coin if he's so inclined. But I think, you know, they would be very strong advocates for Carborough.
Other suggestion was to pick a citizen alternate. Because
Do you have a suggestion out of the applicants?
I think my preference is to pick someone that lives closer to the landfill. So any of the
woman on Tally Hall.
That would be Reverend.
Tracy Kuhlman lives out that way. Is that
Susan Simone owns property on Rogers Road.
So
my thinking was that, and maybe given the alderman involvement, this is kind of outdated, but the commissioners already, they explicitly appointed three people from the neighborhood, and they're asking us to appoint someone who can speak for Carborough. And in that regard, given the nature of the issues, I thought the applicant, Daniel Mone, who's a member of the Transportation Advisory Board and understands issues related to the transportation system, road improvements, our goals in terms of connectivity, those kinds of things, would be a very good appointment if we were appointing a citizen.
Well, I guess I think the opposite. I think in some respects we continue to talk about inclusion, but we exclude the newly people that we've annexed. So my suggestion is to pick one of those women. But y'all can vote, but I'm just telling you what my suggestion is.
And the county asked for one... specifically for one appointee.
And the meetings are going to be open anyway, so even if we don't appoint anybody, I mean, I support the appointment of the two elected officials, but I'm just saying, you know.
No, I understand. I understood your point.
I can't exactly say that the hours I spent there were among the happiest of my life, but I do think that they were among the most important, and that was almost 10 years ago. And I think I have... an understanding of the issues. I think I have some degree of trust and some understanding of relationships. So I don't care whether I'm officially appointed or not. I really want to be there. I just feel like I have that history, and I feel like I owe it to that community to be a part of the new discussions.
My proposal was not that you not be the representative. I was saying that pick one of those women as an alternate when you could not go.
Right.
I will second Dan's motion. Is this a motion?
Yeah.
Which was, what Dan's motion was the two aldermen and Daniel Amoni as an alternate, or you were just saying just the two? Just the two aldermen.
I mean, something you say, right?
It seems awfully simple to appoint the two aldermen and...
I can support
and
that.
Leave it at that. Let's do that. So that's the motion from John. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously.
Thank you.
I have one piece of information for our new appointees, which is at the Transit Partners. We've been talking about the issue of bus service up Rogers Road, and what we've discovered, or really what the transit director has discovered, is that Orange County bus service actually goes down Rogers Road en route to the Southern Human Services Center, and they are it hasn't happened yet, but they've been attempting to begin discussions with them on what might be involved in having some stops on Rogers and coordinating a timing with a connection onto Chapel Hill Transit, so you all can help advocate for that to move forward if it's at all feasible.
Okay. That sounds like a good short-term solution.
Could you, not tonight because I'm ready to go home, but sometime, maybe next week, maybe an email, explain the sort of termination to Chapel Hill High route? Because was that route terminated?
It's being proposed as terminated.
Okay. Well, maybe.
And it's because it has very scant utilization. But there's also a conversation underway with the school system in terms of the implications of that. And if it does go forward, it's actually a requirement, I believe, under state law, or maybe it's federal law, I'm not sure which, that there be public hearings on that termination.
I won't say anything right now.
So that won't be the end of that topic.
Okay.
I thought these kids
were supposed to be the most environmentally aware generation.
Can you take their cars away, then they will be.
Yeah, as long as they don't have to travel together.
That's right.
Second. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, matter passed unanimously.